challenging question.
You didn't plug in the numbers.
What's that?
You didn't plug in the numbers.
You didn't plug in the numbers?
Not the expression.
Okay. I see. You needed like a million, I think. You need about a million stars to detect the relativistic aberration. So there's a backstory about this question, actually. So you can read about an actual application. So you might have heard about the Planck satellite, which measures the cosmic microwave background radiation. In 2012, when they released their first data results, which is when I wrote that question because I was teaching another class and I wrote that question for that class, but I thought it was interesting. By looking at the pattern of the hot and cold spots in the CMB, you can actually detect this relativistic aberration due to our motion. So you see that the spots get sort of squished up towards the direction of motion. And there's another thing that you can measure the direction of motion with, which is the actual dipole of the temperature, because if we're moving, we would see the CMB not to have a uniform temperature. And it turns out that, well, those two correlate quite well. So this is the same calculation they do in that paper, just with dots instead of CMB splotches. So you can go to that paper, Planck 2012, relativistic aberration in the CMB. You could read it, and you could say, oh, I've done that calculation. No problem. But the solutions are on the wiki if you want to see what the answer was or how to do it. Any questions that came up, any confusions that we want to talk about?
Okay, I have a question.
Sure.
Yesterday at the end of the lecture, when you derived the Christoffel symbol, there was one point where you said that the proper time detail squared, I think, equals minus the...
Right. So we were saying that the definition of the proper time is basically negative ds squared, right? So let me give a very simple example. So if we write down the line element for flat space, so you remember that was in the shorthand physicist notation, which we will adopt from now on, given by this expression here. Okay, so if I picture a path through space-time, so we'll call that t and x, and I won't draw the other coordinates, and I consider a particle whose world line is defined by x equals constant. So that particle just sits there, and he evolves in time, but doesn't do anything else. Okay? So if I were to evaluate the line element, to ask, say, what is the space-time interval between two firecrackers that explode on this line, or two events, whatever they may be, then to evaluate that, I basically get rid of this part of the metric. There's no deltas there because those events happen at the same position. And so you can see that in Minkowski space, t is basically just the proper time, what we call tau. Okay. So in this case, we could say that, and then we would just identify t as the proper time. Okay. And what is the proper time? The proper time is basically just the time elapsed on someone's wristwatch. The local time. Now there will be more complicated examples. So you know, in general, if I have some, even in Minkowski space, if I draw some arbitrary path, then the proper time along that path won't, in general, be the same as the proper time along this path, and that's something that you then just have to evaluate. Or for example, if you have a space-time that isn't simple and flat, then the proper time will also be different. So actually, we could do an example like that real quick, which will just be good practice. So I showed you the flat space line element. Probably the next most interesting line element is the one for a black hole. So that's called the Schwarzschild metric. And that looks something like this. Okay, so this is the metric on a sphere. Okay, so this line element has spherical symmetry, and it would just describe the line element surrounding a point source, like really a literal delta function source. Okay. So now let's say that I have a black hole, and somehow, by firing rockets or whatever I have to do, I'm sitting at a constant R. So I'm sitting at R equals constant theta equals constant phi equals constant. So now I can play the same trick in my line elements. And so ds squared is now just going to be 1 minus 2gm over R times dt squared. And so you can see that now, depending on what radius I am outside the black hole, there's a relation between what I call the coordinate time, which is t, and then what I call the proper time, which is now, ds squared is negative d tau squared. So stick a minus sign on both sides and make it plus. So in a general case, it'll be more complicated relation between the thing we call the coordinate time and the thing we call the proper time. And this case, with the arbitrary path, actually you know how to do that one too. And this is a great lead-in for my recap from the lecture yesterday. So if we had an arbitrary space-time path, so if I had some arbitrary path, x mu, we saw yesterday, we know the general coordinate transformation law to go from y to x, and that was just dy rho dx mu, and we defined a metric in the line element by just doing a coordinate transformation on the Minkowski space metric, which was in this case given by this dx nu eta rho sigma. Okay, so this would describe some general path through spacetime, and you can see that now if I tried to so even more practice, now I'm kind of using the shorthand, right? Because really what I mean by g mu nu are the coefficients of the dt, dx, dy, right, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see that on an arbitrary space-time path, the proper time will no longer be t. It'll be some complicated function of tx, yz, whatever coordinate transformation I implement. Okay. So that's more about proper time. Any other questions about that or similar things? Okay. Right, so last time we did that, we said let's take an arbitrary path through space-time, and we defined a more general metric that was given basically by this right here. And then the geodesics, or the paths that particles take in this accelerated frame, are given by the geodesic equation, which we introduced. So, so the geodesic equation was just a differential equation for the coordinates of this particle, where we introduced this symbol. And I guess I should be using tau, sorry. Where we introduced the symbol, and that was the Christoffel symbol. And sometimes it's called the connection for a reason we'll see in about 2 minutes. Okay, so this is just the coefficient that tells us about the sort of forces that I would feel in this accelerated frame. And then the punchline was the equivalence principle tells me that I cannot distinguish between acceleration and gravity in a small enough piece of space-time. And so from that, we're led to conclude that In fact, this equation would tell us how particles behave in a gravitational field. Okay, and that was the punchline from yesterday. So from equivalence principle, meaning there's this correspondence between uniformly accelerating and uniform accelerating frame and a uniform gravitational field, we conclude that particles in a gravitational field follow this equation, which was the geodesic equation. So there are some nice properties of the geodesic equation, many nice properties that you hopefully will explore in your relativity course. But another route to the geodesic equation is a principle. And that's the principle that particles, just like people, are lazy. So particles want to follow the path that sort of minimizes the proper time. So there's sort of an action-like principle that you can use to derive this, which is to look for extrema in the proper time on different paths. But we won't do that. Okay, so I told you this thing is called the connection, and there's a reason it's called the connection, because this is actually going to be the thing that tells us how to connect vectors in different tangent spaces in a consistent way. So this is going to be the glue that helps me define vector fields, as we discussed yesterday. So the Christoffel symbol basically defines derivatives of tensors. And in that sense, if I can write down a differential equation for tensors, then I can know how to propagate them through space and time. So so let's talk about that. So my first question is, I'll put suggestive primes here, excuse me. If I have some vector v, is the partial derivative of a vector v a tensor? No. I see some heads shaking. No, it's not a tensor. So why is that? Well, we can prove it really quickly. So if I want to change coordinates, then for the partial derivative, I can just use the chain rule. So here I can have dx mu, dx mu prime, d mu. But then the vector also transforms under a coordinate transformation. So I'm going to get a partial derivative inside here. And now if I expand this out, well, I'm going to get one term that looks kind of right. So I've got a dx mu, dx mu prime, dx nu prime, dx nu, v nu. If this was a tensor, that partial derivative should act on V. So if this was all I had, it would be a tensor, because that's the appropriate transformation law for a rank 1-1 tensor. But I have to also use the product rule and multiply this guy, right? So I also get this other term, which is the second derivative of x nu prime dx mu dx nu times dx mu dx mu prime times v nu. Okay, and that's the term that makes it not a tensor. But you might remember from yesterday that when we derived the geodesic equation, we had a very similar looking set of derivatives. And in fact, that set of derivatives was exactly what we defined as this thing here. Okay, so if I want to make a proper tensorial quantity, I basically just need to subtract off from both sides this offending piece. Okay? And that's all I do. And so that defines for us the generalization of the partial derivative, which is known as the covariant derivative, and it's denoted by this symbol, nabla. So this is the covariant derivative. And this is the partial derivative plus the appropriate connection that's gonna give me the, basically get rid of the non-tensorial piece. So here this was, get the indices right, mu lambda nu v lambda. Okay, so if I do this, and now I check the transformation properties, I'll be okay. Then this thing right here will transform like a real one-one rank 1-1 tensor. Okay, so this object, the Christoffel symbol, helps us define a derivative for tensors. And we can generalize past just vectors. So if I had an arbitrary tensor, then the covariant derivative, if I had a rank KL tensor, I'd have something like this. And the rule is, OK, well, first I have to take the partial derivative. And now I have to subtract off all the sort of non-tensorial crap that I accrue by doing a coordinate transformation on the partial derivative. And so, so the rule is that for every upper index, I add a plus Christoffel connection, I substitute that particular index, we'll call it lambda, and then I've got a sigma, I want to put a lambda here and I want to put a mu 1. So I trade that first index, put it there, and I substitute in this dummy index that gets summed over. Okay, and I do that for every upper index. So I work my way down, I substitute lambda for mu 2, mu 3, et cetera, et cetera. And I just keep going until I'm out of upper indices. And then for every lower index, I do the same. Apologies for the poor board skills. So now instead of a plus sign, I'm going to take a minus sign. And I'm going to do the same type of thing. Now I'm going to introduce a dummy index that I substitute for new one, but in this case I need to put that upstairs and I need to put the new one downstairs, and then I've still got sigma and I've got t mu 1 to mu k. I realize half of you cannot see this, listen to what I'm saying, I guess, to new l. Okay, so basically I take that lambda and I stick it down there. Okay, so that's how to take the covariant derivative of a general tensor, of a rank KL tensor. The rule is just plus signs on the connections for all the upper indices, minus signs for all the lower indices. And homework assignment, try this for a rank 2-2 tensor and just convince yourself that it kind of works. Okay, so I defined a derivative, a covariant derivative, and that's the thing that now I know how to take derivatives of tensors. I can define a way to propagate an arbitrary tensor along some path, and that's the thing that tells me, for example, how to connect vectors in different tangent spaces. That's the physics. Okay, so this is a concept known as parallel transport. By the way, I should say my philosophy here is to show you the ideas, but like, quite frankly, this is a course in relativity, and you'll probably see it again. So just to give you a physical intuition for what's going on. So let's imagine I had some space, or technically speaking, some manifold. And I consider some path through this space, okay? Where at the beginning of this path, I want to define some vector. We'll call it V. And then I'm going to parameterize my path by some parameter lambda, okay? So this could be, if it's a time-like path, it could be a proper time. If it's a space-like path, it could be number of footsteps or meters or, you know, like whatever I want to measure my meandering walk by. Doesn't matter. It's just some parameter. Okay, so if I consider this, then the proper equation, in analogy with what we had here, you could see here, if I had things measured in terms of proper time and I defined a velocity, that would be dx mu d tau. So this already is kind of an equation for the propagation of a vector. So the appropriate equation that tells me how this vector v rho is going to propagate as I move along this path is really literally just the geodesic equation. Rho sigma mu dx sigma, sorry, I cheated, said that was tau, but it's really an arbitrary parameter, v mu. And that has to equal 0. So if we substitute lambda for tau, and we recognize that end of v is the four velocity of a particle, then this is really just the geodesic equation. OK, so that's the equation we need to evolve in order to propagate a vector along this path. So it's a differential equation. And if I give you some initial condition, then I can just literally propagate this guy, and I can tell you what direction the vector is pointing at different lambdas. So this is now a function of where I am along the path. So in the first lecture, I think, or maybe the second lecture, we discussed this problem of me and a friend taking a pointer and meeting at the North Pole, right? So if I just go up to the North Pole, my pointer would, say, be pointing in this direction. But my friend goes around the circle, starts here, goes up to the North Pole, and his vector would be going in a different direction. So in practice, how you would evaluate that would be to solve the geodesic equation on the sphere, or the equation for parallel transport on the sphere. And that would tell me exactly what direction the vectors are pointing. Now, here's where the name, the connection comes in, right? So it's a connection because it pastes vectors in different tangent spaces together. And let's say I had a different idea of how to paste things together. Well, I would define a different connection. So the physics comes in the definition, the particular definition we had for the connection, for the Christoffel symbol. And that's really the physical content that tells me how to take vectors in different tangent spaces and connect them together. So the physics is really all in the definition. Okay, and you know, creative theorists ponder connections with different properties. So there are ideas of how to make it different. Okay, none of them work. None of them correspond to what we observe. But you can postulate and think in a abstract sense what could be different, and things could be different. Okay, so that's sort of intuitively what this thing means. It's really the thing that tells me how to connect vectors in different tangent spaces. And you know, just by the way, there is a equation for parallel transport for an arbitrary rank tensor, and that's just going to be sort of some generalization of this with more connections. Okay, so now we can talk about the last concept we need before we understand everything that goes into Einstein's equation, which is the concept of curvature. And so let's come back to this example. So if I had a sphere, obviously there's some curvature of space on the sphere. Okay, just at an intuitive level, I don't need to give you a formal definition of what curvature means. You all know that the Earth is curved. You know, triangles don't add up to 180 degrees on the Earth, for example. So the consequence of curvature was that if I parallel transport myself on a closed path, I don't necessarily end up with a vector that's pointing in the same direction as where it started. Right? So in this example, I could define this closed path. You know, if my vector was initially pointing up, I take it around, it's still pointing up, I go up here, now it's pointing in this direction, and then I take it back down. And when I get to the end, it's pointing like this. Okay, so it's going to come back kind of cockeyed, right? It's not going to be the same direction when I get back to where I started. And that, in fact, is a way of defining curvature. So I can just parallel transport a vector along a closed path, and I can ask the question, does it come back to where it started? So I think you can convince yourself that in flat space on the Euclidean plane, if I start with a vector pointing in this direction, I move it over here, I move it up here, I move it over here, and I move back to where I started, I will get a vector pointing in the same direction. Right? That's kind of how vectors behave in flat space. We're used to that. So not this means curvature. And that's our definition. So we define curvature when parallel transport on a closed path gives me a non-zero rotation of a vector. And you can imagine doing that experiment, right? That's a very concrete thing to do. I could just walk around with a pointer and have one of you stay put, and then we can compare our pointers at the end of the day. Question?
Aren't there examples of parallel transport of a vector on the curved surface where I don't get any rotation?
So here I have to make a technical distinction. So there are actually two types of curvature. There is intrinsic curvature and so-called extrinsic curvature. So an extrinsic curvature comes about when I embed a surface in some higher dimensional space. And an intrinsic curvature is really intrinsic to the manifold itself. So if I have extrinsic curvature, then it's true that I can find paths along which I parallel transport, and I get the same vector back. Okay, but if there is intrinsic curvature, then that can never happen, and that's really the definition of an intrinsic curvature in a sense.
Yeah, unless you go like along the same path, like you
came back. Yeah, that's right. So there's some commutivity, I guess, that exists. So that's true. If I walk over there and then walk straight back along the same path, then obviously I'm solving a differential equation, and that's probably time reversal invariant. So it doesn't matter. We had a question up here.
Can you walk in a big path that just happens to give you the same thing back? Is it like only for a small path?
That's a great question, and so that will bring me to my next point, which is a local definition of curvature, what I don't have to worry about that. We'll get to that in a second. There was another question?
Yeah,
It's going to say, does that mean that the surface of the Earth is extrinsic curvature then?
The surface of the Earth actually has both, in fact.
Because I think what David might have been thinking about is, like, if I just walk along the equator back to where I started, then I won't,
right.
If I never turn, just come all the way around, I'll be pointing the same direction.
Right, so that's actually related to this question. When I have a non-local definition of curvature where I can do things like walk around the whole Earth, then I do have ambiguities. But right now I'm going to show you a local definition of curvature, and that will not have such ambiguities. Yeah.
Could you again show in the diagram?
Yeah.
Like a path where we get a different vector once we come back.
Absolutely. So why don't I use colored chalk, novel invention, and I will declutter the picture. Okay, so let's say that that's the equator. And so on one path, my closed path, I will start here with a vector that's pointed towards the North Pole. And then I'm going to walk along the equator, for example, to the other side of the sphere. So you're right, if I walked all the way around the equator and I came back to where I started, then I would get a vector that's pointed in exactly the same direction as where I started. So now we're going to walk up to the North Pole. Let's say it's there. And in doing so, now my vector will just go kind of tangent to the sphere. You'll have to just help me because I can't draw that well. So now you agree it's no longer pointed towards the North Pole. It's kind of pointed now tangent to the sphere in a sense. Yeah. And then now we're going to take this and we're going to walk back to where we started. And now the vector is going to be pointed maybe something like this. Right? So I start up and I end up down. Question.
Is the parallel transport non-degenerate? Like, can it happen that during the parallel transport my vector would just like disappear?
Disappear?
Oh,
and
this will always preserve the magnitude. Okay.
Yeah, so one thing that parallel transport always does is it preserves the norm of the vector.
Okay.
And that's a property that's guaranteed by
if you use Levi-Civita.
Yeah,
I was just going to say that's a property of our choice for the connection.
You're not using the wild connection, so you're not going to change that.
Yeah, so it's true. There is content in the connection, some physical content, and that's the thing that guarantees that the norm of the vector is preserved.
If I have locally flat space,
mm-hmm.
you can still have like a global curvature. It's like you can get extrinsic curvature without intrinsic, is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Question?
How do you make sure your vector is parallel? How are we defining parallel now that I guess it's locally parallel, like an infinitesimal shift will keep the vector parallel? Like, how do you make sure the arrow is pointing in the same direction if you don't know how?
Well, this is kind of what it means for the arrow to be pointed the same direction. So it's just a rule for what I mean exactly as you say. You know, what is the shift in the direction of the vector if I keep it more or less parallel to this particular path? So it's defined with respect to a path.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the path is curved, so
yeah.
Even if you move it an infinitesimal amount, it will shift because there is some curvature.
Correct. Yeah, that's correct. Right. I mean, I could use this equation also in this example. It would be overkill because I kind of know the answer. But indeed, you know, it would tell me something about how to move the vector along this path. We had another question.
Yes. What's an example of intrinsic curvature?
So, good. So if the surface of the Earth was all that there was, okay, then the two-dimensional sphere would be a great example of something that had true intrinsic curvature. Okay. Now, if the surface of the Earth was embedded in space, like it is, then the surface of the Earth has both intrinsic and extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic part comes from the fact that it's embedded in one higher dimension. And then the intrinsic part is, well, that's also intrinsic to the fact that the surface of the Earth is curved. So extrinsic curvature is curvature of my choice of how to split space-time into surfaces of constant time, effectively. Okay. While intrinsic curvature is really something that is a property of the manifold, and it has nothing to do, I can't change my slicing of space and time into of space-time into space and time to change the intrinsic curvature. There's no way I can change that. While intrinsic curvature, I can come up with some creative way of slicing things up so that my extrinsic curvature vanishes. If that...
I'll ask you again later.
Sure. Yep.
So I think I understand the definition of intrinsic curvature that you want to give.
Uh-huh.
How would you define extrinsic curvature? Is it just... Are you only defining that for embedded manifolds, and it's defined as the inherited?
Yeah. So let me give a more technical definition. So let's say I have some surface which is embedded in some higher dimensional space. Let's say a space of one higher dimension. So I'm talking about a really crinkled piece of paper in this room. So what I want to do. So there's some local curvature here, say. So what I want to do is I want to define a unit normal to this surface. And I want to ask, at some neighboring point, how did that unit normal change? Okay. So the extrinsic curvature, the formal definition of the extrinsic curvature, it's actually a tensor. It's basically... if we want to define it this way, it's basically the covariant derivative of the unit normal. Okay. So if I change the way I'm embedding my crinkly piece of paper, then I can always make that unit normal the same in some sense, right? But formally speaking, that's how we define the extrinsic curvature. It has to do with how the unit normal changes as I move around, whereas the intrinsic curvature has more to do with this property of parallel transport, and you know, if I go around, come back to where I started, do I get the same vector? Does that put it on a little bit firmer footing, or do you want to follow that up?
Are they going to be the same if you take an embedded manifold and then abstract it and consider its curvature as being inherited by the, its topology as being inherited by the space and everything?
I'm sure you can come up with an example where the extrinsic and intrinsic curvature are the same. In fact, I guarantee you can do that. I think you can always do that. If I'm talking about some embedded surface in a higher dimensional space, I can always change the embedding in an arbitrary way so that I can make those two things equal.
You can limit the intrinsic curvature of what and the extrinsic curvature of what can be equal in this statement.
So I think that if I take a manifold and I put if I take some higher dimension, let's forget the manifold words. So if I take some space and I embed some surface of one lower dimension in that space, I'm guessing, I haven't proven this, but I'm guessing you could probably find a set of coordinates in which the extrinsic curvature and the intrinsic curvature of that surface are equal.
No, because you have the Gauss equations. Gauss equation to relate them. Those be something the square of the extrinsic.
Oh yeah, good point. Good point.
Yeah. So it's
okay.
Like, yeah, you can have that.
Yeah.
So it's like the square of the extrinsic curvature always is the intrinsic curvature.
Yep. So,
but dimensions wise you can't have both of them being the same.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Okay, I think we're getting too far afield than where I wanted to go. You will learn all about that in your relativity course, but thanks. That's a very good point. We had another question. Yeah.
So the surface of a cylinder, it has no intrinsic curvature, but it has extrinsic curvature.
Correct. Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah.
You're saying we can make the extrinsic curvature zero by choosing our embedding, or?
That might be a bad example where I can't do that.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd have to think a little bit harder about when you can and can't do that. Sure.
Thank you.
But there is an equation, just to follow up on your point, there is an equation that if I pick a particular foliation of space-time into space and time, that relates the extrinsic curvature and the intrinsic curvature. And that's this Gauss-Kadatze equation. So there's a way of doing that. Okay. Wow, that was great. So any other questions generated by that? Excellent. Okay, so the way that we define curvature, as I said, intrinsic curvature, so we'll be more specific, is to take a vector, go around a closed path, and ask if I get where I started. Now, as we saw, there are some ambiguities having to do with the fact that if I pick different paths, I might actually be able to find cases where I get the same vector path. So the way we get around that is we try and come up with a local definition of curvature. Okay, so we actually want to find the curvature associated with some point. And to define the curvature associated with some point, what we're going to do is we're going to define a path. So we're going to pick two vectors. A mu and b nu. And these vectors I'm going to take to define a very, very tiny closed path. So I'm going to shrink the area of this trapezoid to zero. And so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take a vector, we'll call that v rho, and I'm going to transport that vector around this closed path. And then I'm going to measure the infinitesimal shift in that vector around that closed path. And so the claim, which I cannot prove to you today because I don't have the time, but which you will undoubtedly see in your relativity course, is that the infinitesimal shift is going to be determined by some linear operator. And that linear operator is going to have four indices. One of them associated with the delta v. One of them associated with the fact that I need to specify the initial vector that I start with. Let me get the ordering right. And then two of them associated with these vectors that tell me about the particular path. Okay. And so the claim is that there's this linear operator that's valid at a point and totally doesn't care about what choice I make for the path. And this linear operator has a name. So that it's a tensor, obviously. And this is called the Riemann tensor. And this is the object that tells us about the curvature associated with a particular point in spacetime. So we can define the Riemann tensor. Follows more detailed proof that hopefully you will see in your relativity course. But we can define the Riemann tensor as derivatives of the connection. So this is roughly given by as follows. Well, not roughly, it is given by as follows. Okay, I offer $2 for someone who checks my indices are all right. It's very easy to screw up your indices when you write so many down, but I think that's right. So you could see that we've got two pieces here. So if you like, we've got this piece here. Remember the Christoffel symbol went like derivatives of the metric. So this is basically second derivatives of the metric. That's this first piece. So So this first piece says that the curvature is fixed by second derivatives of the metric. That kind of makes intuitive sense, if you like. I mean, if I'm talking about the curvature of a surface, probably has something to do with second derivatives. It's very heuristic, but roughly correct. And then we've got these connections here. And that's basically to make these partial derivatives covariant. Okay, so I need to fix up the transformation properties of these connections and the partial derivatives to define something that's really a tensor. So in analogy with the geodesic equation or parallel transport or covariant derivative, you know, these connections appear in a sense to make sure I have honest to God tensors, right? Okay, so the Riemann tensor is something that measures second derivatives of the metric at a point in space. And there are two objects that are formed by just basically taking contractions of the Riemann tensor. Okay, and these are also measures of the curvature. So there's the Ricci tensor. That's got two indices. And it's defined by contracting the middle index and the upper index on the Riemann tensor. So here, again, there's a summation convention. So I need to make sure I sum these indices. And so you can, the Ricci tensor is basically a sum of components of the Riemann tensor. Okay, so that's the Ricci tensor. And then down here, I will squeeze in the Ricci scalar. And the Ricci scalar R comes about by just taking the Riemann tensor and hitting it with a metric so that I actually sum all, or the Ricci tensor, so that I sum all the components of the Ricci tensor. Okay, so R is defined as G mu nu R mu nu. The metric is the guy that raises indices, so this would be R nu nu. And again, summation convention means that I sum those indices. So these are all the measures of curvature, in fact, that we need. And now I can show you Einstein's equations. Okay, so there again are Einstein's equations. I promised you that by the end of the four lectures, you would understand all the elements of Einstein's equations, and now I deliver that promise. So on the left-hand side, we have these quantities here, which are associated with curvature. And curvature, as I said before, heuristically, is something like second derivatives of the metric at each point. This term here is the cosmological constant that was part of the second coolest thing in the world about Einstein's equations that I mentioned in the first lecture, which is that you can describe the whole universe. And that's the piece that might describe why the universe is undergoing accelerated expansion. And then on the right-hand side, we have this stuff that has to do with matter. So that was the energy-momentum tensor. And that was the stuff that had to do with matter. And if you like, this particular combination of curvatures and the fact that I can have a cosmological constant comes about from the fact that energy-momentum should be conserved. And that was one of the other things that I told you in lecture one. Question.
Sorry, the prefactor for the t mu nu is 8 pi.
8 pi g newton over c to the fourth power.
G newton.
Yeah, so that's in F equals g newton m
right.
over r squared g newton.
Sorry.
Yeah, just the normal, the one you're used to, nothing fancy. Yeah. Okay, so briefly, why this particular combination? The reason why this particular combination comes about from the conservation of stress energy. Okay. So I mentioned that the appropriate way to think about conservation of stress energy was to ask that the covariant derivative of T mu nu vanishes. And so it turns out that this particular combination of the curvatures vanishes when I take the covariant derivative. Okay, so if I take the covariant derivative of both sides of this equation, then I'll find that this combination vanishes sort of by definition. Okay, that's a proof you can do. It's a fairly simple proof. That would be a good exercise. This term, I have lambda times g mu nu. And a particular property of the metric is that actually covariant derivatives of the metric also vanish. That's a condition called metric compatibility. That's also actually related to properties of the connection. So things that metrics which satisfy compatibility imply something about the connection, because the connection is defined as derivatives of the metric. Okay, so this is just like a constant term. If I have a derivative, I can have a function plus a constant. And that's the cosmological constant term. And then the right-hand side vanishing is conservation of stress energy. Okay, so and I'll just write out the first part. In fact, that particular combination of R mu nu and R is called the Einstein tensor. Actually, Einstein got it wrong for a while. So originally, Einstein thought that R mu nu equals T mu nu. And then he realized, oh, crap, that implies that energy isn't conserved. I should add something to fix that. And so you can see a trend here. You kind of make a nice guess. OK, curvature and matter are related. So I should have something that has to do with second derivatives of the metric, because that's kind of like curvature. And I should have something to do with matter that's kind of like the stress tensor. Try it out. OK, that doesn't work. Why don't we just stick something in to fix it up? And the something to fix it up was this minus 1 half g mu nu r. Just like over here, we made some guess. Partial derivatives aren't tensors. Let's stick something in there to fix it up. And then we define the connection. That's the thing that fixes it up. Okay. So in fact, like just as a historical sociological note, a lot of times that's kind of how it works, right? You try something, that kind of didn't work. What can I add to fix it up? You know, physicists never get it right the first time. We always just go back and fix our mistakes. Okay, so there's Einstein's equation. Honestly, I could send you off now and you could review the things that I've told you, and you'd kind of have everything you need to think about Einstein's equation. You could do real computations in GR now. So let's talk maybe just briefly a little bit more about what Einstein's equation is and what's in the metric. So we can think of Einstein's equations as a set of partial differential equations for the metric. So if you give me a tmu, then I can write down some terribly complicated set of coupled partial differential equations that tell me what gmu should be. But operationally speaking, that's what they are. So what we could do now is we could basically just count, okay, how many equations are there really in Einstein's equation? So first of all, we need to know what we're solving for. So there's a gmu. Was there a question? Okay. So first of all, what we need to know is what is gmu? So gmu is, on the face of it, a 4x4 matrix. Turns out it's a symmetric matrix. So in general, gmu is a 4x4 symmetric matrix. So if I were to write down the independent components, I've got the diagonal. And these pieces, and for it to be symmetric, this half needs to be fixed by that half. So I could count crosses. There's 4 plus 3 is 7 plus 3 is 10. So here there's 10 components. But if we're in four dimensions, then I have four choices I can make for coordinates. And remember, the physics has to be independent of the coordinates that I choose. So in general, I can subtract off 4. I can subtract off 4 of these components by making appropriate coordinate choices. Or I can make 4 relations between these entries in the matrix by choosing coordinates. Okay, so really, there are 6 unknown functions in the metric. Okay. So in general, if I give you some totally non-symmetrical, messy distribution of matter, I have to worry in general about 4 unknown functions. And these are 4 unknown functions of whatever set of coordinates that I choose. Okay. So there are 6 unknown functions. And so if we were to unpack Einstein's equations, then what you'd find is that in total, we have a set of at least 6 equations. Okay, so 6 partial differential equations. Now, Einstein's equations are really difficult to solve because it turns out that some of these equations look like evolution equations, meaning that they involve time. But some of these equations just involve spatial coordinates, and those are known as constraint equations. Okay. But you're always guaranteed that you have enough equations to solve for these 6 unknown functions. It's just really hard. Okay, so now that's Einstein's equations in a nutshell. And before I talk about some solutions to Einstein's equations, I want to deal with something that you need to see at some point and you need to be comfortable with. Which is units. So let me go on a little tangent here about units. And this is basically laziness, so I don't have to write as many symbols on the board for the next lecture. And I encourage you to be equally lazy in your future. OK, so up until now, I've been putting all the C's in everywhere that they need to be. And the reason that we do that, the reason that we have C in the first place, is because if I think about meters, seconds, kilograms, so on and so forth. These really only have meaning for human scale objects, right? So why do we define the meter and the second and things like that? Because they make sense to us as humans, right? But they are totally not fundamental, right? To illustrate that, let's just look at two of the most important constants in physics. The speed of light. The speed of light is an extraordinarily large number in terms of meters and seconds. If we looked at h bar, h bar is an extraordinarily tiny number in terms of joules and seconds. Okay. So when we enter the realm of general relativity or particle physics or any kind of fundamental physics, really, these units are really annoying. Because now everything is either an extremely big number or an extremely small number. Okay. And I'm lazy, so I don't like to keep track of 10 to the power negative 34 times 10 to the power 4 times 10 to the power 6, and then add up all those exponents and figure out what the answer is in joules and seconds. So what we do in order to solve this annoying problem is to introduce what are known as natural units. And in natural units, we take h bar and c equal to 1. So what does that mean? H bar and C equals 1. So C has units of length over time. And if C equals 1, what that implies is that the units of length are the same as the units of time. Okay, that's what it means. Similarly, for H bar, h bar has units of energy times time. And what that implies is that time is really the same thing as 1 over the energy. Okay. So when I said h bar equals 1, that implies that, that this is true. I can remember a fact from special relativity, which is that E equals mc squared. And so now I can use that fact to trade this and say that time can also be measured in units of 1 over mass. Okay. Mass has the same units as energy. That's how I used to define that. And if you like, I can trade time for length. So length has the same units as energy, 1 over energy, and has the same units as 1 over mass. And now I have a lot of freedom. Okay, so I can choose to express every dimensionful number that I want in terms of a length scale, a time scale, an energy scale, or a mass scale. So now I have all this freedom at my disposal. And so we can make an informed choice. So in making this informed choice, let's pick something that's more fundamental, something that doesn't depend on thinking about human-sized scales, but something that's really sort of a property of the physical world. So what we're going to do is we're going to choose roughly the mass of the proton. The proton is a fundamental thing. It's roughly the weight of atoms. So if I want to talk about atoms, this is a convenient unit. And instead of working in terms of kilograms, we're in fact going to work in terms of GeV, giga electron volts. So that's 10 to the 9 electron volts. And I'm going to choose to measure absolutely everything in terms of GeV. And this is a standard choice. Okay? And the reason that it's a good choice is because protons are the same anywhere in the universe, we think. So as long as the protons are the same everywhere in the universe, aliens in some distant planet who are 50 feet tall can choose to measure things in terms of GEV, and it's and we'll all agree that this is a fundamental unit. We can use that as a common ruler. Okay, so in order to do this, we need to come up with a set of conversion factors, and so I'll just write them here very quickly for your convenience. So H bar C is the thing that I would use to convert between meters and gigaelectron volts. Okay, so H bar C turns out to be 2 times 10 to the minus 16 meters times GeV. H bar is 7 times 10 to the minus 25 seconds times GeV. Okay, so that's the thing I would use to convert between time and GeV. C squared, which if I use E equals mc squared, is really just energy over a mass, has units of energy over mass. We can express this as 6 times 10 to the 26th GeV over kilograms. So that's the number I would use to convert from a mass to an energy. Okay, so just for, yeah?
Is there a reason why people don't set a mass constant to 1 also?
We will get there. They do, indeed. So so when we meet the Planck mass and the Planck scale, then indeed a mass scale is set to 1 as well. But we will be there in just a few minutes. Okay, so so we get to know each other a little bit better. Why don't we compute my height, weight, and age in units of GeV? Okay, so I'm about 2 meters tall, and I can convert this into inverse GeV by dividing by 10 to the minus 16 meters times GeV, and that's going to give me roughly 10 to the 16 inverse GeV. Okay. So that's my height. My weight. I think I weigh around 80 kilograms, but maybe a little bit less. I don't know if I'm being optimistic there. At some point, I weighed less than that. So now I multiply this by 6 times 10 to the 26 GeV over kilograms. And that would give me about 4.8 times 10 to the 28 GeV. So if you're concerned about your weight, this is probably a terrible unit choice, right? Because it makes it seem like I'm really enormously heavy. And then my age, that's the scary one. Okay, so I'm 35. 35 years is about 10 to the 9 seconds. So I've lived about 1 billion seconds. Seems like a really long lifetime. And so I can divide this by 7 times 10 to the minus 25 seconds times GeV. And I seem really old because I'm 10 to the 33 inverse GeV. So these units can be very useful because then it can allow me to make some estimates about the physical world that I might care about. So I could ask, for example, how many atoms are in my body? So I'm mostly made of carbon, let's say. I don't know if that's really true. I'm probably mostly made of oxygen or dominantly made of oxygen. But you know, 10 is a nice round number. So you know, like the average atom in my body has 10 neutrons and protons, let's say. So one atom would be roughly 10 times the mass of the proton. Okay, so I know the mass of the proton is about a GeV. And that means we can see from here that there are about, let's say, 5 times 10 to the 27 atoms in my body. And if you do it more carefully, that's pretty much right. So that's kind of nice. I can think about things in terms of, yeah, say the number of the atoms, number of atoms in my body. So let's look at my age. So 10 to the 33 inverse GeV. Why am I still here? So if I have the physics of the proton, right, or a neutron, right? So if I have a neutron that's not in an atom, it decays pretty fast. And the time scale of the decay is set by the constants that go into the physical properties of the neutron. Okay, so there's going to be something in there that's going to be on the order of MeV or GeV or something like that, right? So here, this is saying that atoms are actually extraordinarily stable compared to the energy scale that goes into defining them, which would define their decay time. So this number tells me that in our universe, any distant civilization would agree we're very lucky to have a very stable proton. Okay? We're very lucky to have very stable atoms. Okay, they live really long compared to the time scale that characterizes them. Another thing, so we could ask, for example, how relativistic are protons at 7 TeV, which is relevant because that's roughly the energy scale that each beam of in the new run of the LHC will be at. So how relativistic are protons at 7 TeV? So you remember the gamma factor, which is the energy over the rest mass. If I have a 7 TeV beam over 1 GeV, then you can see that the gamma factor is roughly 7 times 10 to the 3. And you could compute how fast the protons in the LHC are moving, trivially. And they're moving at a velocity of roughly 1 minus 10 to the minus 6 times c. So pretty close to the speed of light. So here are some contexts in which this choice of units can be useful. These aren't human scale things, right? This is the scale of atoms. This is the scale of proton decay. This is the scale of stuff going on in particle physics. So these units can be useful in that context. Okay, so why don't we just skip ahead? I have a few minutes. And I will tell you about the Planck scale. Okay, so let's talk about a mass scale. So someone asked if there's any mass scale that we end up setting to 1. So that's Newton's law. Let's figure out what the units of G Newton are when h bar equals c equals 1. So on the left-hand side, we've got a length over a time squared. On the right-hand side, we've got G Newton. We've got a mass over length squared. OK, so if length and time are the same when c equals 1, I can get rid of those. And so G Newton, and if length is equal to 1 over mass, right, then G Newton has units of 1 over mass squared. Okay. So if I want to work in units where G Newton equals 1, that's equivalent to working in units where I have a mass scale equal to 1. Okay. So I can still play this game. I can still express everything in terms of GeV. And it turns out that there are a nice set of constants. I've actually already done it, but we'll just define it more formally and dot the I's and cross the T. So this mass scale is called the Planck mass. Okay. And if I want to put the H bars and C's back in, then this is H bar C divided by G Newton. So G Newton is 1 over a mass squared, so mass squared is 1 over G Newton. Okay, and the Planck mass is quite a big number. So if we measure it in terms of GeV, it's 1.2 times 10 to the 19 GeV. That works about out to be about 2 times 10 to the minus 8 kilograms. So it's a fairly significant weight. And if you calculate the energy that this corresponds to in joules, so a human-sized unit, then this thing is roughly, if I look at E equals m Planck c squared, what I'll get is about the equivalent of 10 gallons of gasoline. So that's actually a pretty significant energy. I can drive my car for 600 kilometers on one Planck mass worth of energy. That's actually a human-sized unit. Okay, so this mass scale is pretty big. And I can also define a length, so that would be the Planck length, by multiplying together different powers of G Newton, H bar, and C. Okay. And Planck length, well, it's easy to know what that is. I know that a length is 1 over a mass, so this is about 1 over 10 to the 19 JeV. Okay, so that's the Planck length. And if I were to compute what that is in human units, this is 1.6 times 10 to the 9 is 35 meters. So this is a really, really incredibly tiny distance scale. Correspondingly, I can compute the Planck time. And the Planck time, well, actually, we don't even need to do the work. This is just L Planck over the speed of light, because that's the thing that takes me between length and time. So this is also 1 over 10 to the 19 JeV. And if we were to compute this in seconds, it's about 5.4 times 10 to the minus 44 seconds. OK, so an incredibly small time scale. So if we want to talk about gravitational physics in a really fundamental way, okay, so if I really want to talk about the underlying fundamental theory of gravity, then I have to contend with these length and distance scales. And in fact, that's a very large part of why quantum gravity is so difficult, because it has to do with length and distance scales that are incredibly tiny and energy scales that are incredibly large by the standards of particle physics, where that would be a JeV. So it's 10 to the 19 times higher than the mass of a proton. I'll have some things to say tomorrow about quantum gravity, but in a nutshell, this is kind of why it's so hard. And that's my tirade on units. Sorry, you will all need to get familiar with that. Like really, really important. It seems like a very basic thing, but it's actually extremely important that you're comfortable with that. So as a homework assignment, you all must compute your height, weight, and age in terms of GeV. And you don't have to share your answer with anyone, but you need to compute it so that you've done it. And maybe also in terms of Planck masses, Planck lengths, and Planck times. So how many Planck times old are you? How many Planck masses do you weigh? And then it'll just give you some practice in using these different units. Okay, so any questions before I set you loose? Yep.
About the components of a metric tensor.
Yes.
You said that they are less four because we have some relationship to the metric.
So there's less four because I can make four coordinate choices. And by choosing coordinates appropriately, I can either make relations between the metric components so that they would be equal, for example, or I can set some of them to zero. But at my disposal, I have four extra conditions that I can use to reduce these 10 components to 6 independent components. So I might still have 10 components lying around, but they won't all be independent anymore. They will be related so that really I have 6. Yep.
You said some of those are constraint equations and some are evolution equations?
That's right.
So how do we know how many of each do we have?
Very good question. So you need a formalism to split space-time into space and time in a very particular way. So this is called the ADM formulation. And when you write Einstein's equations in this ADM formulation, then there's a fixed number of constraint and evolution equations. So you have one constraint called the Hamiltonian constraint. You've got 3 constraints that are called the momentum constraints. And then the rest are evolution equations.
I think we get around 6 equations and 4 constraints, basically.
So you will, you're always guaranteed. So it depends on the formulation that you choose to write Einstein's equations in. But you're always guaranteed to get enough. You will always have enough equations to solve for 6 unknown functions. That's guaranteed. Any further questions? OK, if not, I'll see you tomorrow morning for the next lecture.